What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with two chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show, Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. Much excitement on the show today, as for the last couple of weeks, we've been speaking to people from Chorley, because they're playing, they're doing very well in the FA Cup at the moment. They're playing Wolves in the fourth round later this week. And we've spoken to the football manager, we spoke to a teacher, a student, a pub, a vicar. And today we managed to twin the show with Chorley. We got the deputy leader of the council on, a small ceremony was held, and now Chorley on Times Radio is twinned with Chorley in Lancashire. And we'll check in with whenever we want to find out what things are like, whether it's in a school or a hospital or a pub, then we'll check in with Chorley. Also on today's show, I spoke to Lord Fowler, the Lord Speaker, about how we might go about becoming a member of the House of Lords. Everyone seems to be doing it these days, and why he thinks there should be fewer people on the red leather benches. But first, our columnist panel. It's Thursday, so it must be Webb Cram. It's Esther Webber and Robert Crampton. Let's start with all of that then. Joe Biden, Boris Johnson, how are they going to get on? We understand that Donald Trump has left him a letter, but we don't know what it says. And there's this question of, is Joe Biden woke? Let's take a listen to what happened when Sky News asked Boris Johnson that exact question.
I can't comment on that. But what I know is that he's a fervent believer in the transatlantic alliance, and that's a great thing, and a believer in a lot of the things that we want to achieve together. And, you know, insofar as nothing wrong with being woke, what I can tell you is that I think that it's very, very important for everybody to, and I will put myself in the category of people who believe that it's important to stick up for your history, your traditions, and thing, and your values and things you believe in.
There's just something very funny about just a question completely throwing a politician off course like that. Esther, does it matter whether or not Joe Biden is woke? I mean, what was really striking, I thought, about that clip is it does expose, on the one hand, Boris Johnson has got lots of things in potentially in common with Joe Biden on the environment and trade and that sort of thing. But if he's going to try and continue to fight the culture war back home, there's a tension there for him at the very least.
Yeah, I think that's right, because whatever you like to call it, Joe Biden has been quite unabashed in his campaigning, putting civil rights at sort of centre in his agenda, including gay and trans rights. And that is uncomfortable territory for the Prime Minister, because something a lot of his ministers like to talk about and say, almost kind of show off how unwoke they are. And he sort of said he'd put himself in that category too, saying, you know, to be proud of tradition and things like this. So it does area of tension, and maybe not one he'll be sort of seeking to emphasise.
Without being too simplistic about this, Robert, it's basically the tension of Boris Johnson trying to, you know, appeal on the world stage in one direction, but hold on to what he sees as the good people of the Red Wall who delivered him that election victory last time round. And we see, you know, the likes of Ben Bradley, I can't remember, he's an MP for Mansfield, I think. You know, those MPs who spend an awful lot of time tweeting angrily about pronouns and bias training and all that sort of stuff.
Sorry, go on.
No, carry on. What do you make of that?
I know what you mean, but I think that's slightly unfair on the Red Wall. I think a lot of that opposition will be coming from solidly traditional Tory MPs in the South, and you know the sort of people who have been arguing, have been getting hot under the collar about this in saloon bars for you know, in the dog and duck for decades. So it's a bit unfair on the people of Mansfield. It's more like the people of Surrey. However, I take your point. I mean, and Boris is supposed to be articulate. But, I mean, that was almost Prescottian, wasn't it? It wasn't quite that bad. I think the grammar just about held together, but the ums and ahs were pretty legendary. Yeah, I mean, the point is that the Democratic Party, which Biden's got to look after, is well to the left of the Conservative Party, which Boris has got to look after. And that is a definite discrepancy. I mean, you've got to think is, if Boris was still a Daily Telegraph columnist, what sort of columns would he be writing about Joe Biden and the Democrats? And I guess he'd be making great capital and great fun out of a lot of their stances on various issues, wouldn't he?
I imagine so.
The members and his MPs would be lapping it up. So
yeah.
I think that's where he's coming from. It's a potential problem. It's not necessarily a massive problem, but it might stand in the way of a good relation. And also, Boris is carrying the burden of the Biden's predecessor having called him Britain's Trump. I don't think he is Britain's Trump, because I think Trump is pretty unique, but that is something he's going to have to overcome.
And I suppose that's, if you were in Number 10 right now, that you'd probably be advising Boris Johnson on how to prove that he definitely isn't Britain Trump, and not falling back on some of that old stuff. But Esther, we had the strange spectacle of Robert Jenrick, who our colleague Patrick McGuire in the Red Box morning email this morning described as the least interesting and ideological cabinet minister you could think of. Even he was going after what he called town hall militants and woke worthies. Just randomly find this out in a column in the Sunday Telegraph. Esther, what would you be telling Boris Johnson to do right now in the next few days? Because there's a danger they overthink this, and he pops up in the weekend papers doing something which actually causes a massive row with America.
Yeah, I think, you know, just stick to the stuff we have in common, stick to, you know, the welcome message. This is just the beginning of potentially quite a long alliance between Boris Johnson and Joe Biden. The kinds of things that Robert Jenrick was talking about at the weekend, which obviously people will get fired up if you start a conversation about statues, it's all very well. But I think a lot of the Red Wall voters who the government is so keen to keep on side think there are bigger priorities, you know, there are bigger fish to fry. And talking about kind of economic prosperity and potential trade is probably more of a winner, I think, looking ahead.
Yeah, the housing secretary may be talking about, you know, making sure people have got a roof over their heads rather than raking over statues again. Mm. Make more sense. And another tension that Boris Johnson faces is what's he going to do now he's done Brexit? There was so much debate and tension and rows and battles over getting Brexit done. Now it is done. What does he do with it? Do we basically stay in line with the EU and enjoy the fruits of trade with them, or head off to what's been called Singapore on the Thames, which is the idea of, you know, you cut red tape, you cut regulation and let business sort of let rip. The story in the Times today, the EU is prepared to ease post-Brexit border friction. It's not so easy to say. Post-Brexit border friction if Britain drops its plan to create a Singapore on the Thames. So there'll be fewer checks at the border if Britain agrees not to go for broke and cut lots of regulation and diverge from the EU. This is a question which has never really been addressed, Robert, as far as I can tell. What is the point of now we've got all this freedom, what do we want to do with it?
Well, quite. And this is where the red wall does come into play, I think, because if you're serious about the deregulation and bending the working time directive and those elements of what you certainly used to be called the social chapter, then that does affect the people who switched to vote, you know, from Labour to Tory in those seats, in those Northern and Midland seats, and they are not going to like that at all. I mean, that might go down well in parts of the South. It will not play in those seats that gave Boris his majority. So he needs to think very carefully about that. Also, has he got Brexit done? Because, I mean, he's got it done formally, but it's a little bit of a mess at the moment. I was always, I was a Remainer, but I was always reasonably optimistic about, I didn't think there would be sort of catastrophic implications, but it's not good, is it? For people having their cheese sandwiches confiscated by French customs and Scottish fish not being able to be exported, and people having to pay more for deliveries from stuff imported from the EU, and some couriers saying that they're not going to ship stuff here. That isn't really, I mean, there still needs to be some serious negotiations done on those points.
And Esther, someone who was asking the question, why did we leave, was Sir Ian Duncan Smith, who was speaking in the House of Commons. And you wrote about how the quiet man was turning up the volume again.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the red wall and the new intake, who are obviously the kind of fresh flavour of the Conservative Party, I thought it was interesting that a lot of the ideas that are kind of dominating the party at the moment were articulated by someone who you really can't think of someone less fashionable than Ian Duncan Smith.
Text in the usual way, 8722, start your message with the word anyone less fashionable than Ian Duncan Smith.
Yeah, because, I mean, not just Euroscepticism, which obviously he was a proponent of, but the kind of focus on welfare and how we think about welfare and the job it should be doing, and also this kind of moral emphasis, which he brings to questions like China. Obviously, another big issue with the Biden administration and how we position ourselves on that. So it just seemed to me he was sort of an unlikely poster boy for some of the big ideas in the Conservative Party at the moment.
Who'd have thought?
I suppose you could say that Jacob Rees-Mogg was less fashionable, but then we're all sitting at home watching kind of Regency period dramas, so maybe he's actually kind of man of the moment.
Yeah.
And even Jacob Rees-Mogg did have that brief stage of being sort of, you know, cultish. An L.
You could see him in Bridgerton, couldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. I think he did have his face on some cloth bags. Yes, exactly. That does seem to have blown over. Just finally, Robert, let's talk about your column. That was what Esther wrote about this week. What did you write? What was your column on this week?
My column, well, there's one coming up which is about walking in lockdown, but the one I wrote about, what I wrote about yesterday was probably more interesting, was about the whole issue of class and people being misidentifying their own class. This is on the back of a survey from the LSE saying that a whole bunch of actors who were actually impeccably middle class went around saying that they were working class. So a bunch of us wrote about our class origins in the Times.
Yeah, and what was your... Because we talked about this briefly earlier in the week.
Impeccably middle class, but because I come from Hull, a slightly flat, as I used to be, people always assumed that my dad was like a coal miner or a docker, and he was actually an MEP.
And very good.
Explain to people, grew up in a urban semi with two... In the south, there's an assumption that the middle class does not exist north of the Trent.
Exactly. Yeah, everyone in the north has got a whippet and a flat cap and all that. Just before I let you both go, what do you think Boris Johnson should buy Joe Biden as a gift to try and win him over, Esther?
I don't know. Maybe some potatoes. Probably like them, the Irish.
Very good. Potatoes. That's playing into stereotypes, but I don't think the Prime Minister's averse to that. What about you, Robert?
Oh, well, he's got rid of the bust of Churchill. Maybe Boris should send him a bust of Trump and he just could look at it and think, whatever he did, I'd do the opposite. That would work.
Esther Webber and Robert Crampton there. And of course, you can read them both if you get yourself a Times digital subscription. Just go to the Times, click on any story you'd like the look of, put your details in, and as a bonus right now, you can get your first month for free. Up next is my chat with Lord Fowler.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced, from the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beat brand for heart health support. The new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to radiobeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's radiobeats.com, code DEAL.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, and now we can bring you my interview with Lord Fowler, the Speaker of the House of Lords. Before we begin and get stuck into the sort of the latest controversies, let's go right back to the first principles, if you like. What is the point of the House of Lords?
The point of the House of Lords is that... Sorry, this is, I'm getting a back feed on this. The point of the House of Lords is really that we scrutinise all legislation which goes through. And if we didn't do that, then the result would be that you would get some very incomplete and very... a bad legislation. We do literally hundreds of amendments. I mean, that's one. And point two is that we hold the government to account. So I think all the opinion polls show that if the House of Lords is valid for anything, it's for their experience. And they like the idea of there being a second chamber which can cast an eye over what is being done. And if they disagree, then they can challenge it. But as you know, it very rarely goes to a vote. But when it does go to a vote, it is on very crucial issues.
And what is your role as the Lord Speaker?
My role is first in the House itself and sitting on the woolsack, rather like Lindsay does in the House of Commons, but also... I'm chairman of the House of Lords Commission, which is progressively running the House of Lords. And we have a whole range of committees and duties under that. So it's both administrative, and it's also political as well. And to some extent, and I don't claim this to be total, I try to speak for the members of the House of Lords. I think I'm about the only person who is directly elected. And therefore, I think I have perhaps that authority in saying that.
So obviously, I touched on it, that over Christmas we had this row where Boris Johnson announced, was it another dozen or so new peers, including former Tory donor, the Tory donor Peter Cruddas, amongst others. What is the right number for the House of Lords to do its job properly, do you think?
Well, I thought that Terry Burns got it about right at about 600. We certainly don't need the present total, which is, one side of 800, probably 817 rather than 792. But, I mean, let's not quarrel about that number. But it is around the 800 mark, which is, markedly in advance of the House of Commons. And I think the important point to remember is this, that when Terry Burns and his committee did their report, I welcomed it. We had a debate in the House of Lords, and the House of Lords welcomed it. And most important of all, it was welcomed, I think, by the Prime Minister at the time, Mrs. May, who said that she was now going to commit herself to a course of moderation. That's the first time a Prime Minister has ever said that sort of thing. But of course, a change of Prime Minister, and we now go back to where we were before. And I think that that is a vast pity. It's not a political point. It's simply a point about seeking to organise and run the House of Lords in the best possible way. We don't need 800 people in the House of Lords. And that includes, of course, people who don't actually do very much in any event, don't do anything at all, really. Most of them are hardworking, but the people who don't work, I think, cast a shadow over the rest of us. So I think everything points to a lower house of 600. You could argue for 500, but 600 would be fine. But 820, that's too many.
I sense that when you're talking about the people who don't, who've got the title but don't do any work for it, I sense you've got people in, any particular people in, you've got in mind when you're saying that?
You're not going to tempt me down that particular road. I'm a speaker. I have to respect all my members in the same way, but you only have to look at the attendance records to see who I'm talking about and the voting records. It's all been a bit confused, of course, now because of the new system, but consistently we've had people quite very well-known people who haven't made much contribution to the House of Lords and wouldn't make any bones about it, that they are not working members of the House of Lords. Well, with respect, I don't think... membership of the House of Lords gives great privileges, and the first privilege it gives is that you're a member of the legislature, that you're passing laws that apply to the whole of the public. I mean, not to turn your back on it. I mean, seems to me a complete negation of the whole idea.
And is that where, because it's got sort of slightly tangled up, there's sort of two things. There's partly taking a role in the legislative process, going through laws and making sure they're fit for purpose. But it's also just, it's a supercharged gong. It's one up from a damehood or a knighthood. And so it ends up being a sort of reward, it's have the title and all that sort of stuff. And when you've got lots of party donors, in the last round we had not just the Tory party donor Peter Cruddas, but we had the Prime Minister's brother, his friend, the newspaper owner Evgeny Lebedev, just doing all that rather than thinking who are the best people to look at legislation, rather than being a sort of reward for being, particularly supportive or just friends or related to the Prime Minister. Does all that bring the House of Lords into disrepute, do you think?
Yes, of course it does. And it is one of the fundamental criticisms. I mean, there was a proposal some years ago to have non-parliamentary peers. So if you wanted to give a reward for public service or whatever it happened to be, then you could do that. But it didn't mean that you went into the House of Lords and had a vote in all these issues that comes soon. Not even the Americans do that. The Americans are big into contributions and all that sort of thing, but there's no way that you can actually, by making big contributions, get a seat in the House of Lords, or help to get a seat in the House of Lords. I must be careful about what I say as far as that is concerned. I mean, all that needs to be cleaned up, frankly. It doesn't do us any good, and it doesn't, I think, reflect well on the government either. And when you have, you know, when you do have a situation where the appointments commission make a proposal and then that is just simply ignored, then I think we get into really difficult territory. So, I mean, there are a lot of issues to be cleared up about the House of Lords. I don't deny that, but I'm a reformer of the House of Lords. I'm not someone who wishes to see it abolished. I want to see a second chamber, but I do not deny that we've got, you know, a number of big obstacles in our way. But they're not obstacles that can't be overcome. Of course, we can overcome them. We need the will to do it. And I would say my slight complaint about the government is that I don't think this government is actually taking the House of Lords very seriously. And it's about time that they did.
How would you go about whittling it down then? If the Prime Minister did suddenly get gripped by the fact that this situation's got a bit out of hand and picked up the phone to you and said, well, how should we do that? I'm fine. Let's go for 500 or 600. How would you scrap everyone and start again? Who would have the job of telling the 200 odd that their services were no longer required to make sure that you had, you know, people who know what they're doing going through the legislation of the day and not just friends and donors and former colleagues of the Prime Minister?
Well, I think that one way or another, you've got to have some kind of inquiry into it, because there's a whole range of issues to be considered. And I would much prefer it to be an independent review of the House of Lords rather than one done internally in Number 10 or in some other government department. I don't see there's any way round that. But I think the public should be involved. I think it should be as transparent as possible. And what one doesn't want is simply one issue picked off the shelf. You could say retirement age. Let's have retirement age. And that is fine if you put it together with all the other issues that come with retirement age and with the reform of the House of Lords. But don't just pick down one issue and say that that is a total solution, because it isn't remotely. So it's up to the government, obviously, how they proceed, if they want to proceed at all. But I don't think the present system, in my view, can't be sustained forever. And, I mean, you know, the things like party donors and things of that kind, which also, we just need to have rules about that, which are enforced and which bite. I don't think anybody in the public would actually really seriously debate that that is the case. And so let us just do it and just sort of leave it to one side, and with occasional leaks or things of semi-leaks from government saying this is what we're going to do or this is what we're not going to do. I mean, we need to be much more open about it and look at the House of Lords. And if I could just say one more word, Matt. Most of the members of the House of Lords are hardworking, very hardworking. The great thing we have is experience. We've got experience from law, medicine, nursing, armed forces, media, the whole thing. And I think that the range of abilities that I've seen here are as good and, frankly, better than many of the range of abilities that I've seen over the last, certainly the last 30 years in the Commons. And I think that we need to preserve the very good and not tar everyone with the brush of what we've been talking about.
Just when you talk about there being rules, do you think there should be a rule that if someone's donated a certain amount to a political party, they can't take a seat in the House of Lords?
Well, I think something in that area is called for. It needs to be clearer than it is at the moment. You could either do that, or you could put an absolute block, absolute limit on how much people could contribute. But what you're proposing is a very interesting way of doing it. I haven't any firm views on that. That's obviously a matter for the government and for the political leaders. But I think it is, every time there is a row about a party donor or supposed party donor kind of coming in, we go around the same old course. And it's about time we got it reconciled one way or another.
If someone's listening to this and they want to be an MP, it's pretty clear about how you go about doing that. You can, you can run as an independent, which might not be terribly successful. You can become a party candidate and stand for election. If someone's listening to this and they want to be a peer to take part in the legislative process of the country, how would they go about doing that?
That's a very good question. And there's no clear answer to it. I mean, the fact is that we have three major parties in the House of Lords. They all have their different ways of nominating peers, because it is the parties in the end who make nominations on most of the members, apart from the crossbenchers. And so it is a matter of being respected and being valued in that way. I don't know if there's any other way that one could actually do this. You can make applications. You can make an application to become a peer and become a crossbencher. But there haven't been many of those that have actually gone through, as it happens. So it's really down to the parties and number 10, I mean, who is chosen. And you can't, I mean, quite a lot of people, you can't really, most, I think, you can't really challenge. I mean, you could say, there's another person who's just as good. But, I mean, all life is full of those kind of decisions. But it's not like the days that I remember as a member of Parliament when I went to a selection committee and I put myself forward to the selection committee. And then we went from round three to round two to the final. And finally, you became the candidate, and finally, you became elected. I'm not quite sure whether that is quite such an ideal situation position as some people imagine. But it's obviously the Lords is very different to that.
I want to ask you about that, because you've touched on your long career in politics. And I wonder how you think politics has changed, whether for the better or the worse in that time.
Oh, I think in many ways it's changed for the better, in the sense that when I first went into the House of Commons in 1970, community politics, as it was called, constituency politics, was still in its infancy. Now I think you'll find members of Parliament who devote themselves to their constituency. And of course, with the internet, they have many, many more letters and objections and suggestions to deal with. So I think that members of Parliament, and I think members of the House of Lords, well, certainly members of the House of Lords as well, work much harder than before. Where I think politics has been harmed is in the growth of the social media. I think that I remember with the COVID crisis, I remember going into Guy's Hospital to get my first jab. And a photograph of that appeared. It appeared in House of Lords magazine, not nationally, but it got a certain amount of circulation. And then I found that people were coming in on the social media to say that it had all been posed, that it wasn't a real needle at all that was going in, it was something else. The idea that I would go all the way to Guy's Hospital to pose for a photograph of having a jab, I mean, it's so extraordinary. And it's that sort of thing that drives me to slight desperation
about the social media at the moment. It's very good in many ways, but my golly, there are some very odd people about at the moment who are a peril to navigation in all kinds of ways.
We obviously saw, you know, take the extreme of politics on social media. I mean, culminating those awful scenes at the Capitol building in Washington and the riots they saw there. Since what happened in America, has Parliament reviewed security? I mean, obviously there have been tragic incidents around Parliament in the past. Have you been reviewing security in the light of what happened in America?
Well, we've obviously taken note of it. We'd be mad not to. We have a different system here, and we have very close, I mean, we have our own security people, obviously, but we have also the very close cooperation of the Metropolitan Police, not just cooperation. As you well know, there are Metropolitan Policemen all around in Westminster. But any of these kind of incidents which take place, we would clock into, see if there were lessons to be learned, and we would go on from there. But you know, we've got quite a good system, and I'd be mad to say that it is foolproof, because no security system is entirely foolproof. But I don't think that the kind of thing that happened in Washington could have happened at Westminster.
I wanted to look back, because obviously, Lord Fowler, you were, before joining the House of Lords, you were a cabinet minister for many years in the Thatcher government. Two things leapt out to me when I was looking back over it. First of all, your time as health secretary. And reflecting, particularly while you were health secretary, the AIDS crisis erupted in the UK. There's this Channel 4 documentary. It's a not documentary, drama, in fact. It's a sin, which starts this week, which looks back at that whole period. And a lot of the actors in it, I think Russell T. Davies has written it, there are parallels, inadvertent almost, between the public reaction to that back then and the public reaction to the coronavirus crisis. What do you remember about that time as Health Secretary when AIDS first emerged and the government's role in trying to warn people about it?
Oh, what I remember about it was, first of all, it was a tragic time. And secondly, there was so little initially that we could do about it. We didn't have any drugs and we had no vaccine. I mean, we don't have a vaccine now. It's good that we're getting a vaccine for COVID, but we've still got no vaccine as far as HIV is concerned. So the only weapon that we had at that stage was publicity. That's why we sent leaflets to every household in the country. That's why we had posters all over the country and advertisements in the press and the rest. But it was our only weapon. And that's why I say, I mean, I was fortunate in as much as social media wasn't about, frankly, at that time. So I didn't have all these, at least didn't have counter strikes from outside. Although I did have, just as Matt Hancock had, I did have lots of alternative theories about what I should be doing. I had people who said, this is entirely a moral issue and that you should go out there and you should preach what they described as moral issues. My only conclusion from all that, which I think is very much Matthew Hancock's conclusion, is that the safest and the best thing for the public is to keep to public health. What is in the best interests of public health? And just as I had a very good man called Donald Acheson, who's the chief medical officer. He's got a very good man called Chris Whitty, who is his chief medical officer. And as long as you keep very close to the medical advice coming from them, then I think that is the best that any health secretary can do in any situation.
And is it right, when you launched the first public health campaign warning about AIDS, you had to sort of slightly sneak it past Margaret Thatcher?
Sneak it past, yes. We it was rather more than sneaking it past. When we first started, I wanted to warn the public And there's no point in warning the public in a general way and pulling your punches. So I remember the first advertisement we had was, we'd had something on risky sex and how to avoid it and why you should avoid it. Margaret came back and said, oh, dear, you know, do we really need this thing on risky sex? Well, obviously we did. Otherwise, we weren't going to be communicating with anybody. And she was a bit of a peril to navigation, frankly, as far as the AIDS campaign was concerned. She didn't really have her heart in it. And I remember right at the end of my, well, no, not quite at the end of my period, but I wanted to have a ministerial broadcast on AIDS. And I went to see Margaret, and it was New Year's Eve of all times. I tell you, she wouldn't move. To have a ministerial broadcast, you needed the Prime Minister's permission, and she wasn't prepared to do that. And then she said to me, Norman, she said, you mustn't just be known as a Minister for AIDS. Now, I totally misinterpreted that by saying, well, obviously she means that I'm going to be Chancellor of the Exchequer in a few weeks' time. She didn't mean that at all. What she actually meant was, Norman, pack up what you're doing and go and do something more useful. I mean, that's a pretty crude way of categorising it. She didn't have her heart in the AIDS campaign. And when I went, I think you could see a slight contrast between what Paul John Moore was allowed to do and what I just did. So I did go round her, but it wasn't before we had a number of conflicts on the way. But the greatest thing I had was that we managed to get a special committee, AIDS committee, now a cabinet committee. Normally the Prime Minister would be in the chair, managed by various means. She wasn't in the chair. Willie Whitelaw was in the chair. Norman Tebbit wasn't there, who was a pretty good sceptic on the whole thing as well. And we, from that moment onwards, it became a team. And they bonded together, and we had a really good campaign. I know it was controversial campaign, but we brought HIV down and we brought sexual disease down. And, you know, I mean, I don't think I could have done much more, frankly, as Health Secretary at that time.
We'll be people able to see how some of that played out in that Channel 4 drama. It's a sin. I just want to ask you finally as well. So you left being Health Secretary, you became Employment Secretary. And then you famously resigned to spend more time with your family, that possibly the first person to use that formulation. But you really did just want to spend more time with your family. And it's only later that this has become sort of a euphemism, if you like.
Yes, I wasn't at all conscious. It was only one phrase or one sentence in my resignation letter. And I wanted to move on, and I did want to spend more time with my two young daughters, who were very young and who I had neglected. I'm not sure. I hope they think that they were less neglected. But the trouble with being a politician is that you do tend to neglect your family in any event. But I did feel that quite strongly. And I had done 15 years at this stage with Margaret Thatcher, both in opposition and in government. And we'd had our clashes and we'd had our battles, but I had a lot of respect for her right to the end. Your family is most important. I remember Margaret saying to me, because when I went to see her and saying, I'm going, she said, Norman, she said, the family is the most important thing. And I think that she very much believed that. And actually, I believe it. But I don't pretend to be a perfect father, and I can hear the applause for that statement coming from my children as I speak.
Well, that's it for this episode of Red Box. If you've enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Maybe even leave us a rating because it helps with the mumbo jumbo charts. We release an episode every day, Monday to Thursday, featuring the best bits of my Times radio show. You can listen to the whole thing Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. It's available on DAB online via smart speaker or on the Times radio app. If you want to read more about all of the stories we've been discussing, then go to times.radio/subscribe.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.